Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak about the new book by the former director of the Central Intelligence, George Tenet. His book, At the Center of the Storm, is already creating a storm, and he will be appearing Sunday night on 60 Minutes. We'll be talking to somebody who worked closely with George Tenet. Tyler Drumheller is the former chief of the CIA of the CIA's covert operations in Europe. He retired from the agency in 2005 after a 26-year career, and he's the author of On the Brink, an insider's account on how the White House compromised American intelligence. And we'll be talking to him about the book and his experiences and the extent to which there may be some divergence of opinion about what happened vis-a-vis the case of a fellow codenamed Curveball, who was, in fact, a dissembler. And we'll be talking about how Curveball's information, bogus that it was, ended up in the presentation that Secretary of State Colin Powell made before the United Nations. And then we'll speak with General William Odom, who's a senior fellow and director of at National Security Studies at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. He's also a professor at Yale University. He was the director of the National Security Agency during President Reagan's administration and also head of Army Intelligence in that same period. He also worked as Zbigniew Brzezinski's military assistant on the National Security Council during the Carter administration. And Saturday, he delivered the Democratic Party's response to President Bush's weekly radio address. And then we'll talk with Stephen Cull, who's the director of the Program on International Policy Attitudes at the Center on Policy Attitudes. He's a political psychologist who studies world opinion on international issues. And they've just come out with a poll published about attitudes in the Middle East and the worldwide, documenting a serious turn in world opinion against the United States in the last 6 years. We'll begin now speaking with Tyler Drumheller, who, as I mentioned, was a former chief of the CIA's covert operations in Europe. He retired from the agency in 2005 after a 26-year career, and he's the author of On the Brink, an insider's account into how the White House compromised American intelligence. And as you know, Tyler Drumheller, in the new book that's already creating a storm, at the center of the storm, George Tenet does apparently talk about the incident that we spoke about before and that you've covered extensively in your book about the use of intelligence from some of Chalabi's people, including Curveball, who came out of Europe, out of West German intelligence. And I remember we talked about this, and you basically told him that prior to Secretary of State delivering his evidence, if you will, before the Security Council, that Curveball stuff was not reliable, that he was a drunk and a dissembler. And George Tenet groaned. What more has he brought to the table? Because the New York Times is suggesting that he contradicted what you said.
Well, he contradicted what I said even before all these books started being written. When the Silverman Robb report came out, that's when he issued his first statement, saying that he didn't recall this, and if he had. And I think that's going to be his standard defense on this, that he doesn't remember the discussions we had and that perhaps I'm remembering speaking to lower-level people instead of to him, and he knows what the truth is on this. The fact is that the good thing about the book is that a lot of the facts that he has in it, sort of the policy-level facts, confirm the things that I said in the beginning in my book about that the administration came into office with the idea of going to war, and then they were looking for bits and pieces to stick into it. Some of it, as you said, came from the INC. Curveball actually wasn't influenced by the INC. He was outside of the INC. There were five or six others that were related to the INC. But Curveball, what made him more damaging was that he was basically just a singleton fellow. He had some family ties to the INC, probably, but he wasn't being driven by them. They didn't, in fact, probably even know where he was at that point. But the sad thing here is that I believe George probably was upset when he heard, you know, they were going to war, they were doing this, but he was there, as he says, at the center of the storm. He, you know, it was a time for him to stand up and say something. The other part of it is, and this is what he has a hard time coming to grips with, I think, is that not only were they cherry-picking, as they say, intelligence to go into the justification for the war, and he was aware of that. He also was aware that a lot of the intelligence they were cherry-picking was false, the Kerbal in particular, and that there was other reporting that contradicted what Kerbal was saying that wasn't getting into it. So they raised the bar for saying inside the agency, the bar as set by George and John McLaughlin, and was set very low for things that went along with what the administration wanted to hear, and very high for anything that contradicted it. And that is why this is all... George is a decent guy. I think he probably does feel guilty, but it all rings a little hollow at this late date. And and he also, I think they're also counting on the fact, Kerbal's just one case. It's out there because the Silverman-Robb Commission published the details of it. There are numerous other cases that I can't talk about and he can't talk about because they're classified, and that's sort of what he's counting on, where analysts or operations officers came forward and said, there are problems with this reporting, and either George or more often McLaughlin for George said, well, you're going to have to work a lot harder to prove to us that that's not good, because this is what the White House wants to hear, essentially. Mm-hmm.
And what about the other Tyler Drumheller, that you mentioned on 60 Minutes, that the CIA had a source inside Saddam Hussein's inner circle? And in the fall of 2002, this source told the CIA that the dictator had no active weapons of mass destruction program, and apparently this information was ignored. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. We had, after a lot of work and working with the European intelligence service, we obtained a source at a very high level, ministerial level, inside the government, very close to Saddam, and in a series of meetings in, through the fall, but the most important ones were in September of 2002. He reported that they had their nuclear weapons program was 2 years away from producing a bomb once they had the fissile material, and he wasn't even sure about that. That's what he was being told by his engineers, and Saddam suspected they might just be telling him that so they didn't get killed. The second one was there were no biological weapons except for what they call the chemistry set capability. They had been destroyed either during the first Gulf War or by the during the inspections that followed. And then the third was that there were chemical weapons in the sense of poison gas left over from the first Gulf War, gas shells. But these are defensive weapons designed to fire as a last resort against advancing Allied troops or even into Israel to distract the Allied troops. But these are really almost sort of, these are very rudimentary weapons, not with the same effect of either biological or nuclear weapons. Now, that report, I briefed Tenet on it, that one personally. He came back, told me the president was very excited because we actually had our own source inside of Saddam's regime, which we hadn't had before. And then the case officer who actually ran the case and debriefed the source, it was actually a go-between between us and the source, briefed McLaughlin, the number two at the agency, and had a similar exchange with him on it. Now, what we found out later was the report wasn't even written up as a final report until the next April. It was briefed verbally to the White House, and by the time it finally sort of saw the light of day, it had actually been altered. They put a preamble. Someone had put a preamble on it that said Saddam Hussein has an extensive and aggressive weapons of mass destruction program, which the agent never said. And then the report comes in. So in the last summer, when I had a very heated exchange with the staffers of the Republican staffers of the Senate Select Committee over this issue, and even though it wasn't put in the report because they knew, I think they knew I was right, Senator Roberts chose to write a, Roberts and Chambliss actually chose to write a letter in which they attacked me personally for having, you know, saying, and they actually said, well, this report shows, and this is, this shows, when you add it to what George is saying, sort of the bizarre mindset that was at play, is that this shows that, okay, they didn't have it, they were years away if ever from having it, but it showed that they intended to do it, therefore it was a reason to go to war. And that's the kind of madness that was going on.
And, of course, the Rockefeller, who's now taken over that committee, has yet to really aggressively pursue the Phase 2 report. It got distracted by DOD's Inspector General's look at the office of, you know, the as they joke, and the CIA jokingly calls Fife-based intelligence.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the thing is, just from my experience with them, and I frankly don't want to have anything more to do with them because I had a pretty nasty exchange with the, again, it was primarily the Republican staffers, but they, the committees, the two intelligence committees are so polarized between Republicans and Democrats right now that it's very difficult for them to get anything substantive done. So everything has to be a compromise. So to really, for Rockefeller, it's really hard for Rockefeller to press the issue. They can hold hearings, they can have, I know Senator Levin actually was very interested in pursuing this, but they have, it's, I think it's going to, and then there's this feeling that, well, we need to look ahead, not backwards. But the fact is, the answer to what lies ahead lies in how it started. Sure. And that's where they're, if you always say, well, let's look ahead, not backward, you're doomed to, you know, Santiago, you're doomed to repeat the failures of the past.
But there also may be something more mendacious here, Tyler Drumhill, and that is that if you look at the MO that the president, the vice president, has been conducting here, where, for example, you know, they would leak stuff from Chalabi and the vice president's office to Judy Miller. She would write it up in the New York Times, and then Cheney would then go on Meet the Press and quote it back. And the same thing happened apparently with Tenet, and Tenet reveals this in his new book that it was obviously Vice President or Cheney or Libby that leaked to Bob Woodward the slam dunk comment. And then that becomes the Bible, if you will, on the record of what happened. And then Cheney later repeats this back again on Meet the Press to justify the war. So my feeling is that what the subtext here all along, and if you get, particularly when you go to the Niger forgeries, which seem to be a flagrant smoking gun here that nobody's really looked into, I get the feeling these people were feeding back bogus stuff that maybe they even had a hand in creating.
Well, that's always possible. We looked really hard at the Niger forgeries on that, and it's very difficult. I mean, you know that Michael Ledeen is involved in all of this, and that Michael Ledeen, conservative.
Right. Well, he threatened to sue me when I first revealed that he might have had something to do with it.
Yeah, and he denies that, and then there's others involved in it. But I think, you know, the other thing that no one's really looked at is, as far as we can tell, and I mean, the thing you need to realize is as George was saying, he knew nothing about Curveball, he wasn't interested, why was he constantly pressing us to get access to Curveball, to confirm what Curveball was saying? I mean, really desperately trying to get it at a time when, and that was coming directly from his office. Well, but because there's an interesting twist in this. Like I said, Curveball, as we said, wasn't directly linked to the INC. He apparently has a relative who was a member of the INC, but he himself wasn't. Curveball's sort of a hustler, charlatan kind of guy trying to make money on the side. And when he did work in Iraq at the ministry that was involved in this, where he picked up his rudimentary knowledge, he was fired for selling equipment in the office and things like that. But they had, but there were INC, the INC defectors and some of the others that came out who were either admitted to being fabricators or failed polygraphs and then admitted, you know, later on this. And this is all buried in the Silverman Rob report. The problem is it's so dense that most people can't wade, don't have the time or, you know, the inclination to wade through all the verbiage. But these five or six other defectors confirm parts of what Curveball said. even though they had no direct contact with Curveball, and because we know Curveball was making up on the spot everything he was saying, someone was feeding back to them what to say to confirm what he was saying. I mean, that's always been my, I always thought it wasn't the INC running him, that in the end of the day, it was people in the Pentagon taking what he was saying and feeding it back through the INC to these other people, that it was going the other way, if you see what I mean.
Sure. Well, the Tenet's book apparently reveals a meeting that took place at the CIA with a liaison from Italian intelligence, who then starts saying, do you guys know about this, about United States government officials meeting with exiled Iranian opposition officials? And apparently Tenet looked like, what the hell's going on here? And then he sort of finally figured out it was Ladin, and he referred to it as the son of Iran-Contra.
Yeah, but he did know about that meeting. I haven't read the book yet. If it's written exactly as they said, he's not being completely honest there, because I was in that meeting. And he did know that there was a meeting like that had taken place.
I see.
He had been briefed on it. Although we weren't part of it, it was a Pentagon initiative. But I think what he's doing is describing that he was, shocked that the Italians brought it up with him.
Well, one of the things that I've always been puzzled about, Tyler Drumheller, and apparently he mentions it in his book also, George Tenet, he said, you had the impression, he sarcastically writes, that some office of the vice president and DOD reps were writing Chalabi's name over and over again in their notes like schoolgirls with their first crush. I never could understand how a guy that embezzled $300 million from his own bank, who's wanted, convicted in both Jordan and in Switzerland, where do they find these people?
Well, Chalabi is, he's another one of these guys. He's a graduate of the University of Chicago. He had a lot of the same professors as a lot of the prominent neocons. There's a link there. And he has worked very hard at ingratiating. And he's, for all of his many foibles, I haven't met him, but he's said to be a very charming and, and eloquent guy. And so he convinced, what he found, and being a clever sort of shyster, sort of flim-flam man, he found, just not much, very along the lines of Gorbanifar, but smoother, that he found a group of people, early on, even before the mid-90s, maybe even back in the late 80s and early 90s, who were looking for someone who was willing to say, who was saying to them, all these supposed differences in Iraq that the British warn us about, and it's, that I talked about earlier about the Sunnis and the Shia and the Kurds and the Turkmen and all the other things. Don't worry about those. The Iraqis are united in their hatred of Saddam, and I have my network all over Iraq, and if you guys come in and attack, and I'll come in and I will, and I'll be there and I'll build Iraq in the American image. And he had no and it turns out he had no network at all. He had nobody. He had his exile group, and that was it. But he figured out what they wanted to hear, and he told them. And that's a little bit of the problem that George has too, frankly. George Tenet's whole career was as a Senate staffer. He's not an intelligence officer. He never worked in intelligence. He never was a case officer or an analyst. He was a staff person in the Senate, working in various committees, and he ended up on the Select Committee on Intelligence and was the staff director, and then Deutsch bought him in to be the deputy director after the Ames affair, because they thought they needed to straighten out the agency. But his inclination is to give the, the principal, in this case the president, what they want. I have a friend who knew George and worked with him in the Senate, same world, and he was talking to him yesterday. He said, I can see what he was doing, where he didn't agree with these guys. He saw, they're writing down Chalabi, they're using all this stuff. But it would go against every sort of fiber of his being to stand up and say, hey, wait a second, this is not right. But instead he'd say, well, maybe I can get the president alone and tell him quietly, and it never happened. But the DCI has to be willing to be the person that says the bad news,
And you know, if he was too compromised by his friendship with the president, and they did apparently develop a bond during the Afghan War, and that apparently irritated the hell out of Rumsfeld. But the long and the short of it is that if he would have had a strong deputy there, I take him McLaughlin's a bit milquetoast, isn't he?
Well, McLaughlin again is a guy that has a reputation for wanting to please all sides. McLaughlin is, I mean, the sad thing is I was friends with both these guys, and they both, I think they both really are very, they don't like me very much now, but they have, McLaughlin similarly is someone who's trying to sort of, instead of saying, here's what we know, here's what it is, if you don't like it, well, you know, you can't say that because we're not telling you what you want to hear, we're stupid. This is what we have. And then, but instead, sort of saying, well, this, as I said, they set the bar very low for things that please the president, like curveball, and they tried with uranium yellowcake, and they even compromised on this sort of weasel language that was used in the State of the Union address. You know that the British have a report that says this. Yeah, the British had a report, but it wasn't true. But if you had something such as we did, which is proving that curveball. We have real questions about curveball's validity, and another report saying that probably all this stuff was not true. That they said, well, no, you got to have more than that. You can't just have that. And there are other instances of that again that are still classified that can't come forward of people that were trying to push this forward, and whether it got, you know, it was hung up at the McLaughlin level or how much got to George. The real issue is, in my mind, is that the White House created an atmosphere where you couldn't go back to the president and say, you know, what we told you before has turned out not to be true, or there are problems with it, and we need to look at it. It was, he liked George after 9/11 because George came in and said, we're going to go to Afghanistan, and we're going to just knock the heck out of these guys, and we're going to get them, and, you know, had Kofor Black saying we're going to cut their heads off and put their flies on their eyeballs and all this stuff. And that's what the president likes to hear, boom, 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 you know, and instead, you know, to come back and say, well, it's a lot more complicated than that. That's not what they wanted to hear.
Well, just in closing, Tyler Drumheller, do you think there will be any accountability? I know there's an attempt to subpoena Condoleezza Rice, and, of course, she's featured in Tennant's book where they, Kofor Black and he, on July the 10th, are so alarmed they go and have a meeting with her and say something big's going to happen, we're going to be attacked, and she brushes them off. So everybody's dodged the bullet around the inner circle there. Do you think there'll ever be any accountability?
I think the accountability was the last election. It'll probably be the next election. I think they have, you know, those are civics. That's a civics lesson. The American people just said, wait a second. And I think years from now, people are going to look back at this year and say, what happened? And you had a group of very sort of mediocre people took over the government, complete control of the government for 4 years, and followed an agenda that was set out in advance without having to deal with what was going on. And I think it's going to tell in the way that it's looked on by history, but also what happens in the elections from the future. I mean, I heard George Will this morning, of all people, say the Iraq War could be the same as the Depression was for the Republicans. I mean, this is going to be something that's going to haunt them for years. And they have, because it is, as I said this a year ago, people say it now, this is going to be the worst blunder in American diplomatic military history, because it's far worse than Vietnam.
Sure, and the worst is yet to come. Sure,
and it's not going to get better, because if they don't stop now, and they won't stop now, it's just not in their. They just can't do it. They just can't bring themselves to do it. It is going to get worse and worse. And by the time the next, and I'm afraid the people in the country are going to get really fed up, and it's going to cause a lot of disillusionment and problems in the country. But no, as far as accountability, that's true about that meeting, because I ran into, that's actually even in my book, I ran into Kofor and George when they were coming back from that meeting with Rice, and they both said, we just tried to talk to Rice and she won't listen to us about this threat thing. And, you know, whether, and, you know, they just don't remember, they don't recall, so it's hard to pin them down. And I don't think they'll be, I said it's a civics lesson. I think the accountability will be at the ballot box.
I thank you so much for joining us, Tyler Drumheller.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I've just spoken there with Tyler Drumheller, who's the former chief of the CIA's covert operations in Europe. He retired from the agency in 2005 after a 26-year career, and he's the author of On the Brink, an insider's account into how the White House compromised American intelligence. And, of course, he was able to talk very knowledgeably about the former CIA director, George Tenet, whose memoirs, In the Center of the Storm, coming out soon. He'll be on 60 Minutes tonight. Let's now talk to the unusual man to deliver the Democratic response to President Bush's Saturday radio address, a former general. I'm speaking with General William Odom, who is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. He is also a professor at Yale University and was the director of the National Security Agency during the Reagan administration from 1985 to 1988, and also during the Reagan administration was head of military Army intelligence from 81 to 85. From 77 to 81, General Odom was the military assistant to the president's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. On the National Security Council staff, he worked on strategic planning, Soviet affairs, nuclear weapons policy, telecommunications policy, and the Persian Gulf security issues. And Saturday, he delivered the Democratic Party response to President Bush's weekly radio address. And in that response, General Odom, you made, I think, a very telling point, which is that the war in Iraq has only benefited Iran, it appears, at this point, and it's been at the great detriment of the United States and its standing in the world. And you point out that the United States cannot win a war that serves our enemies' interests and not our own. And, of course, together with Iran, the other beneficiary of this war has been al-Qaeda. How much is the al-Qaeda component exaggerated? It seems to me that...
Well, it's not exaggerated. Its role there is grossly distorted. It was only able to come into Iraq because we invaded it and opened it up. Saddam couldn't stand it because... As a secular Arab leader, he was one of its major targets, just like the royal family in Saudi Arabia is a major target, and Assad in Syria. By opening the place up, the Iraq, al-Qaeda cadres began to come in, and as the Sunni, primarily Sunni, but Ba'athist party organization, began to develop its insurgency, it found these volunteers coming in with money and with weapons, capabilities, skills, useful. So there's been an alliance. And the importance of that alliance you can see from the effects on recruiting. Throughout the year 2002 and to about half of 2003, al-Qaeda's recruiting plummeted. They were doing very, very badly. As we bogged down in the summer of 2003 in Iraq, it began to climb. It's climbed ever since, inspired by this opportunity to kill Americans in Iraq. So it has been able to bring in the outside suicide bombers. Iraqis don't seem to want to sign up to be suicide bombers. But so al-Qaeda can supply those. The Kurds in the northern part of Iraq don't let al-Qaeda work there at all. The Shiites in the south and east try not to let them operate there. And the Sunnis have very mixed feelings toward them. Many of the Sunnis would like to cut them apart and drive them out. There has developed, I've been told, a real Iraqi branch of the al-Qaeda, which is populated with native Iraqis. They are less interested in the United States and more interested in taking the country back and fighting that operation there. So they're not headed out to the United States. Most of these other people who come in and survive a while and develop good combat skills, good techniques in actual operations, some of them go back to where they came from and are sent off other places. So that's sort of the complex situation. I think if the U.S. troops were withdrawn entirely, al-Qaeda wouldn't have much left. It wouldn't last very long in Iraq. I think it would have a very short life there.
I guess it's a self-depleting resource too. If they use themselves, if the Ba'athists are using them as suicide bombers.
Well, that's true, but they're not using the people coming in. The organizers and the leadership in al-Qaeda don't do that. They find young people who are inspired by their rhetoric and propaganda and to do it for them. And they seem to have an inexhaustible supply from various places throughout the Arab world.
And you did the Democratic response as a nonpartisan, I take it.
Yes, I made it very clear that I've never been a Democrat, nor have I been a Republican. I'm a serving military officer, and that I made my points as someone who has some expertise in national strategy and intelligence.
So I take it you don't buy the White House critique that the bill that the House and Senate has sent to the president's desk, which he threatens to veto, is an interference in the president's ability and the general's ability as in the executive branch under executive branch orders to prosecute a war.
Well, I made a couple of points in that regard. In principle, I've seen meddling in foreign policy implementation by the Congress have very bad effects. Therefore, I'm not inclined to be for that. I think the president, by saying the generals don't tell him to pull out, the generals don't do this, the troops don't want that, to hide behind that is to abdicate his command responsibility. And that's the game he's been playing. So I say he's essentially acting as if he were absent without leave, or AWOL, as we say in the Army. And that with this leadership vacuum, the Congress is the only mechanism we have to fill it. And it's there with reluctance that I encourage them to the administration to accept that bill. I mean, we're going to be bogged down and continue to make things worse for ourselves. We cannot revise our strategy for a meaningful, useful aim in our interest out there, and that's regional stability, not victory in Iraq. We can't do much about that now except contain the chaos we've created, and we can't do that by ourselves, and we can't get allies of significance until we get out. So getting out is a precondition for getting on a strategic path to some kind of victory in the region. And the path we're on now, we've already been defeated. It's a question just the issue of how long we're going to intensify our own pain, postpone any kind of genuine progress.
Well, you know, I couple of weeks ago, General Adam, I spoke with Ali Alawi, who's one of the few clean Iraqi cabinet people. He's former defense and finance minister. He's written a book about his experiences.
Yes, I'm aware.
And his feeling was, as long as Iraq is held hostage to American domestic politics, it will be a catastrophe. And he totally refutes Senator McCain's idea that if we pull out, it'll be a bloodbath and a catastrophe. He, in fact, says that if we pull out and empower the local, the regional players, the Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan, they can weigh in and bring stability because it's in all of their interests to have stability. They're looking into an abyss, in other words.
Well, I have always advocated that as we pull out, we should launch two levels of diplomacy. One is to offer to the Europeans who scorned us and stood aside an opportunity to join a coalition, which would also include, I would hope, countries like Japan and China and South Korea, to make sure that the major powers don't get involved in any big fights down here in this region. And another level, all those countries contiguous on Iraq to get them to start talking, to limit the spillover and the chaos in Iraq. Now, there are already countries doing that. I think someone, the Saudis, have organized a conference that's to occur soon at Sharm el-Sheikh. The Turks quietly have been running a multilateral string of relations with the surrounding countries. So I think Alawi has a very valid point there, a very compelling point to me. I don't argue or claim that there won't be a lot of chaos. If you ask me what I really believe, because people say, well, there will be, and you just underestimate it, I think we have to get out no matter how much the chaos is, because staying in makes it worse. But if I had to bet, I don't think there will be anything like the so-called chaos that's predicted.
Well, it's the Sharm el-Sheikh conference. Iran has just announced that they're going to join it. So it seems that things are happening in spite of our...
Absolutely. We've left a vacuum there, and sooner or later these people take over. I would not be surprised to see us asked to leave in the not too distant future. The present government wants us to stay because they have no real clout within the country. They have no strong constituents. I think the best way to tell who has strength in the political leadership structures in Iraq is to see which ones to live in the green zone and depend on Americans or outsiders for protection. Those people who have real constituencies there and can deliver local leaders don't need those kind of bodyguards. They have bodyguards against each other. So those people are not the ones we're talking to. We're talking to the people that we've brought into power, like Maliki and others. And if we go, they will probably go. So naturally, they don't want us to leave.
Well, he was a minor Dawa Party functionary.
He was. He was our favorite for quite a while. He was a defector from Saddam's regime. He was part of Saddam's police intelligence, and as guilty as crime of anybody else. And he even worked for the CIA afterwards. So, I mean, he's been around. He's an experienced man. He's obviously understands the situation quite well.
Well, it's just that I always, whenever we say the Iraqi army and we say the Iraqi government, I always have to sort of, hold my breath a little bit because I feel
there's no such thing.
Exactly, I feel that I'm adding to this collective fiction that we can keep repeating back to ourselves.
Well, the president's done that to us. He talks about we they out there. It's not we they. It's the Sunnis and the Shiites and factions within the Sunnis and factions within the Shiites and the Kurds and it's Al-Qaeda and it's the U.S. government with this phony Iraqi government in the green zone sitting on top of this volcano we've created. And not only is it just that, if you think that's the only enemies or the only players involved here, you have to look at the outside sources. Iran is deeply involved. You can bet Saudi money is funding the Sunnis. The Syrians are involved, probably Jordan. Probably the Turks have intelligence operatives down there all over the place. So the sides here are complicated, and they're not limited to Iraq. And to make these simple statements about we, they, why don't we stay in and beat them? Who is them? And I think the president has been highly irresponsible in lumping together all that diverse set of enemies who can't stand each other as if it was us versus them.
Well, General Odom, I know you've talked about the president being AWOL, and I noticed when he did an interview earlier in the week with Charlie Rose, there's a peculiar passivity. It's as though he's not responsible or accountable. He basically says, "Oh, General Petraeus has got it under control. Let's wait until the troops get in and the surge has a chance, and but he'll report back in September." And he says the same thing about Alawi, and he's got to do better. But it's as though he's not really in charge. It's almost the same thing that happened with Katrina, where Brownie was in charge, and only when it blew up in his face did he have to step up to the plate. But do you detect this bizarre kind of passivity? Is it
that's precisely why I use the term AWOL.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know another way to get that over to people at many levels of society fairly clearly. Now, those who may not be familiar with Army lingo may not recognize it, but I spelled it out. It's an acronym for absent without leave, and in the Army, it's a courts-martial offense.
And he's commander-in-chief.
He's commander-in-chief. The commander-in-chief's gone AWOL.
So,
I mean, we're just adrift with nobody at the top. You've got him up there pointing his right finger to the left and his left finger to the right, and all fingers pointing in directions except toward him. There was a day when the man in the White House had a sign on his desk that said, "The buck stops here." He took the blame. There was a commander of Normandy, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who before he made the decision to launch the invasion, penned a telegram saying, the invasion has failed, I bear the responsibility, and I hereby resign. And he had that ready to be sent to Roosevelt in the event that it failed. That kind of courage seems to have disappeared entirely from the White House, the executive ranks, and it's not just this administration. I think it's been this way for at least the last couple of administrations.
But General Odom, it seems to be a little different in this case, that it seems that the president, as a man, is incapable of recognizing the terrible mistake that he's made. You know, in the national security business, you do not put the United States in a situation where there are no good options, and the options just get worse as he delays any decisions and reckoning. And it seems to me that his inability to face up to what he's done and to take responsibility for it is continuing the bloodletting, and that the cynical strategy here is to pass the mess on to the next guy or girl.
Well, that's what one hears secondhand. It's hearsay. I've never heard it, but I've heard people who are in the press corps around the White House have got that from members of the White House staff there. At least that's what they say. I don't know. But it certainly leaves a very compelling inference that that is the strategy. It's my own judgment that events are breaking more rapidly in Iraq than that strategy will support, can be supported with, that they may get ahead of this strategy, and they may not be able to string it out until after the elections in 2008.
But when you say that, events, they're going to be events that will spill more American blood.
Not just spill American blood. Other things will happen there on a level that make it so obvious or even drive us out. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. If we don't start planning to withdraw, we will withdraw under fire the way we did from Iraq, from Vietnam.
So in other words, there's likely to be perhaps a spectacular penetration of the green zone, a lot more blowing up of these kinds of things, smaller forts that the surge is creating around the city of Baghdad, and even the portent of being driven out. I guess reality has always been the enemy of the administration. But what in terms of spreading the blame, which I know the president is trying to shift the blame away from himself, but there was a Lieutenant Colonel Yingling who wrote a piece in the Military Affairs Journal criticizing the general officers.
Yes, I've read that.
What's your take on that?
There's a lot of truth to that. I felt very much the same way that he does during the Vietnam War because, I wouldn't have missed the war, but I knew early on that the war was in the interest of North Vietnam and Soviet Union containing China. And that's what the official reason for being there was to contain China, to prevent the spread of communism into the South.
But the winners were North Vietnam and Russia.
Those who studied the situation knew that Ho Chi Minh would probably be, and I'd heard some old veteran OSS officers from World War II, say that Ho Chi Minh will end up like Tito, a Southeast Asian Tito, opposing the Chinese and not necessarily following the Soviet line. So it didn't seem to me that it was in the U.S. interest to do that. Well, I couldn't believe what we were doing, but we did it. And while I was there, I got the view that the generals really had rolled over, and I think a lot did. Having become one, I said, oh, my God, I'm the enemy now. And I looked around, and I realized that while the generals can do certain kinds of things, they don't have as much latitude as this lieutenant colonel understandably believes. They can stand up and resign. One of the reasons I've spoken out as a retired officer is that during the Vietnam, only one general did that, and that was General Shoup, a retired Marine Lieutenant General. And there were many of us who wondered why we didn't have more people do that. You can argue both ways that the senior officers ought to retire right now or resign in opposition. You can also argue that if they're professionals, that's abandoning the ship. They ought to stay and try to help these people the best they can. I can see a strong case for both, and I respect people who do both. But there are those who are essentially opportunists and want more rank and don't have the moral courage to stand up and confront the political leadership with hard truths. Now, you don't want to push the business of standing up and confronting the leadership too far because generals are not always right. Mm-hmm. Sometimes political leaders are right. So I don't think there's a formula that we can follow as individuals in uniform that always gets the right answer for us here.
I thank you very much for joining us, and also for your putting a foot in the political waters. I know it goes against your nature, but I take it you do it because you consider the...
Well, I did hesitate on this, but Nancy, I didn't even call up a staffer. Nancy Pelosi herself got on the phone and asked me to do it, and promised no interference in what I said whatsoever. It was entirely my call, so what's in there, a word or two's been changed to make it fit format, but no substance has been changed in anything I said in that talk. And I respect her for that, and I decided to take the opportunity.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles, General William Odom.
Well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Master. So just speaking then with General William Odom, who was a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He was the head of the National Security Agency during the Reagan administration. He was also head of Army Intelligence during the Reagan administration and served as a military assistant to Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, and he delivered the Saturday Democratic Party response to President Bush's weekly radio address. I'm now speaking with Stephen Cull, who is the director of the Program on International Policy Attitudes, that's PIPA, and the Center on Policy Attitudes, COPA. He is a political psychologist who studies world opinion on international issues. He directs the PIPA Knowledge Network Poll, which conducts ongoing surveys of the U.S. public and plays a central role in the BBC World Service Poll on Global Opinion. Stephen Cull recently published new polling in the Middle East and worldwide, which documents a serious turn of world opinion against the United States in the last 6 years. And Stephen, it seems, first of all, that over two-thirds, 58%, believe that the U.S. military presence in the Middle East provokes more conflict than it prevents, and only 17% believe U.S. troops there are a stabilizing force. That's not a lot different from actually what's the polling indicates inside this country, right?
Yes, the American public concurs with that view as well, that that the presence of U.S. troops in the region are provoking more conflict than they're preventing. And their particular orientation is, well, what do people in the region want? And if the people in the region want us to draw down our forces, they say that we should. And based on the polling that we've just completed in four major Muslim countries, this does seem to be the dominant theme. Overall, three-quarters support the goal of the U.S. withdrawing forces from all Islamic countries.
It also goes on to say that the world citizens disapprove of the way the United States has handled all six of the foreign policy areas that the report explores. After the Iraq War, 73% disapproval. The majorities across 25 countries also disapprove of the United States handling of Guantanamo detainees. That's 67% against. The Israeli Hezbollah war, 65% against. Iran's nuclear power program, 60% against. Global warming, 56% against. And the North Korean nuclear program, 54% against. That is a pretty comprehensive indictment of our foreign policy, I'd say.
That's right. Another poll that we just released in the last few weeks found that a clear majority around the world do not want the United States to play the role of the dominant world leader. That doesn't mean, though, that they want the U.S. to disengage from world affairs. They want the U.S. to participate more in multilateral efforts. And the perception is that the U.S. is playing the role of world policeman more than it should, that the U.S. is too unilateralist, that it doesn't work through multilateral forms as much as it should. And so the kind of recurring criticism in each of these areas seems to come back to that dominant theme.
And do you think that this would be, is there a will or a wish, I don't know whether you asked this question in your polling, for regime change in the United States? Do they associate the America's position in the world, as it's reflected in this polling data you're providing, with the leadership? In other words, George W. Bush.
Yes, it is important to remember remember that what we're looking at here is not something that's been a perennial. In the 90s, for example, attitudes toward the U.S. were rather positive around the world, and it was in the 2001 through 2003 period that it began to move downward, and it has continued to move downward as well. So it is very much focused on the current U.S. foreign policy. That doesn't mean that as soon as the Bush administration leaves that it will automatically, all the negative feeling will go away. It all depends upon how the new administration behaves. But yes, it's quite specific to the current administration.
And I'm sure you've heard, Stephen Cull, this kind of mantra from people abroad. I recall it going all the way back through the Cold War, that people used to say, well, we love American people, but we don't like your government. And there's always been a distinction between the American people and the American government. I understand, though, that in 2004, when President Bush was reelected, just a lot of people in Europe and the rest of the world basically sort of said, well, you know, you've made your bed, go lie in it, you know.
So there always has been that distinction, and there continues to be views of the U.S. people are not so negative. They tend to be more divided. They're not tremendously positive, and they have gone down to some extent over these years as well. But they're still distinctly better than views of the United States, of U.S. government or U.S. foreign policy.
And did those views improve with the last elections, where the Democrats took back the House and Senate, and clearly indicating to the world that the American people are not entirely happy with this president and this administration?
There's not enough recent data to really establish that.
Hmm. So what is the – is there any impact whatsoever on all of this money that's being spent first by the advertising executive who the State Department hired, and then now by Karen Hughes and I think Cheney's daughter also works in that part of the State Department. I mean, is this something that you can just sort of propagandize your way out of?
There is not any indication that any of these efforts have had any significant impact. The one thing that does appear to have made some impact was the support for Indonesians after the tsunami. The views of the U.S. in Indonesia did go up significantly, but that has already begun to wear off to some to significant extent. The real focus is looking for indications that the United States is constrained, that the U.S. is playing by some a set of rules that everybody understands, and thus that the U.S. is predictable. Right now, there's a lot of nervousness about what the U.S. is going to do next, and a surprising number of countries say they perceive the United States as a military threat. So that's the question they're asking, and the kinds of messages that have been put out by the administration haven't really addressed that question very well.
Is this a fear that the United States will attack Iran? Is that what's...
It's a generalized perception that the U.S. I know it's hard for us to understand this because it's not. We don't think of the U.S. as being very free to use military force, but that's not the perception. The perception is that the U.S. is unpredictable, and it could use military force at any time. And right now, Iran is a major focus, but there are a lot of countries that feel that the U.S. military essentially threatens them.
Hmm. Now, what about after 9/11, there was considerable sympathy to the United States. I understand that there's been a lot of denial in the Islamic world about that bin Laden's responsibility for 9/11. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's changing at all. But I also understand that bin Laden's going down in the polls amongst the people that you've polled that would normally be sympathetic to him.
Yeah. At this point, there isn't a single country in the world where a majority of people have a positive view of al-Qaeda. Now, we just did a poll of four Muslim countries and explored this in some depth, and it's rather complex. Because if you go through a whole list of goals that are associated with al-Qaeda, you find a substantial support for those goals, to have an Islamic State, to have Sharia, to keep Western values out of the Islamic world. All of those are, you know, to stand up to America and affirm the dignity of the Islamic people. All of these things are people resonate with a lot, but they very much reject Al-Qaeda's methods to the extent that they attack civilians. This is a very strong feeling throughout the Islamic world that attacks on civilians is contrary to Islam. Now, when it comes to attacks on U.S. troops, there you get substantial support. Large majorities in Egypt and a large majority in Morocco approve of attacks on U.S. troops.
These are our allies.
Yes, and nonetheless, when we're talking about troops in Iraq, troops in Afghanistan, troops based in the Persian Gulf, you get substantial support. Less so in Indonesia, divided in Pakistan. But overall, three-quarters agree with the goal of trying to get the U.S. to withdraw all its military forces from Islamic countries.
So do you think anybody's looking at the obvious here, which is that in the case of Indonesia, in the case of Pakistan, when the United States intervened with aid after the tsunami in Indonesia and the earthquake in Pakistan, the United States, the attitudes toward the United States improved out of sight. So doesn't that mean that if we had the Peace Corps at the tip of the spear, if we were exporting the Peace Corps instead of the Marine Corps, we may be better off?
Well, I think it would certainly mitigate it. I don't think that would solve all of the problems. A big issue is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the perception is that the U.S. is not even-handed there. We asked whether they believe that the U.S. is generally trying to bring about a Palestinian state, and the majority believe that the U.S. is not trying to do that. Two-thirds even perceive the U.S. as favoring the expansion, the territorial expansion of Israel. So it's it isn't simply sending sending over aid, though those things help. It's also how the U.S. is perceived as trying to impact developments in the region.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Stephen Carlin, for your work in finding out how the rest of the world sees the United States, and of course the disturbing fact that our position and our affection in the world has plummeted in the last 6 years.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Carlin, who's the director of the program at International Policy Attitudes. He just recently published a new poll in the Middle East and the worldwide, which documents the serious turn in world opinion against the United States in the last 6 years. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer. I thank Elliot Fong, the assistant producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, and Tamika Sogi, the engineer.